Okay, if the clerk would call the next case, please.
The court will now call Gufron J. Falk versus the State of Texas. And may I please the court, Mr. Adam Harrington to argue for the appellate, and Mr. Stephen Condon to argue for the appellate.
Thank you. Mr. Harrington, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. I may just have one moment to gather my things. Madam Justice, and may it please the court, we are here, you're all familiar with the facts. It's an appeal from a murder case, and we've raised eight issues in our brief. I won't be going through all eight of them, but we requested oral argument basically to deal with three buckets of issues, if you will. One, the confrontation and hearsay issues, which I believe are issues 1, 2, and 4 in our brief. The second is the matter of the testimony of Saika Marine, or Shulu, which had to do with this conversation she had with the defendant in actually two different languages. And then the third being the so-called rebuttal witness and rebuttal evidence that the defense did not receive reasonable notice of. First, I want to start out by addressing the harm caused by any errors. Some of these are constitutional, others are not. But as I read through the state's brief, I noticed a familiar refrain getting to the issue of whether, if there was any error committed, then it should be deemed harmless because of all the evidence, the bulleted list that they run through of all the other evidence in this case. So as a threshold matter, I want to address that we don't believe that any of these errors can be held harmless for a couple of reasons. One, and this particularly goes to the testimony of Saika Marine and Muhammad Rahman, but also the safe haven evidence that was admitted in rebuttal. It's clear from the record that part of the state's strategy in this case was to portray the appellant, Mr. Zafar, as an abusive, violent, controlling husband. And this was done through this extraneous evidence, through the testimony of Mr. Rahman and Ms. Marine, but also through this safe haven evidence that was offered in rebuttal and that they tried to offer in their case in chief. Had it not been for the admission of this evidence, then the jury would have gotten a very different impression of the appellant. And second, it is true that the appellant told multiple different stories to the police, to Sharon Fonvielle Bauman at the at Safe Haven, and then another one on the stand at trial. And so the state made a huge issue out of his credibility. So it's our position that anything that went to his credibility, anything that damaged his credibility or hurt him, was harmful to him. It either affected a substantial right, or in the case of the evidence that violated his right to confront or cross-examine the witnesses against him, it cannot be held harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So with that in mind, I'll first get to the confrontation and hearsay issues. The forfeiture issue, the forfeiture by wrongdoing, I think the state, I don't want to mischaracterize the state's position, but as I read their brief, I don't think they dispute this point, that by the plain language of the forfeiture by wrongdoing statute, that only affects it basically can only be applied to say that the defendant forfeits his objections based on the unavailability of the witness. So the objections to hearsay, relevance, and the Rule 403 objection, because those are not based on the unavailability of the witness, in this case, the decedent, Mrs. Zafar, the forfeiture by wrongdoing statute cannot apply to forfeit those objections. It's basically the confrontation objection. And there is a paucity of case law on this in Texas, since the statute was just passed in 2013. However, one court of appeals has basically said it's pretty much consistent with the federal standard. And we both rely on Giles v. California, the state and the defense, in our briefs, but I think we have different interpretations of that. This was not a case where the evidence before the court at the time it made its ruling would support a reasonable inference that of the situation described in Giles, where the defendant intended to isolate the victim and prevent her from reporting the abuse. In fact, the evidence showed she went to Florida four times, three of those without her husband. In one case, I think there was testimony that at least one of those times he even paid for her to go to Florida. He sent her to Florida. Not exactly the actions of a husband who's trying to isolate his wife from the outside world. And so basically, if the court accepts the state's interpretation and application of the forfeiture by wrongdoing statute in this kind of situation, then it would pretty much say that this could, any murder case where you bring in some evidence of domestic abuse or domestic violence, in just about any case you could find a forfeiture by wrongdoing, which the statute's intent, the intent of the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine, is to prevent a defendant who deliberately procures the unavailability of the witness with the intent of preventing him or her from testifying at trial. And that's not what we have in this case. This was the obviously the decedent in the case. Tragic though it was, this was not a case where he killed her to prevent her from testifying or to make her unavailable as a witness. As to the testimonial issue, the state challenges whether or not these statements were even testimonial, separate and apart from the forfeiture issue. They rely on a couple of cases. The cases they rely on, Avant and Davlin, are distinguishable. In one of those cases, the statements at issue were made by the declarant in the midst of an ongoing stressful situation, basically an ongoing emergency where exigent circumstances were present. In the other one, Davlin, they were made in the immediate aftermath of it, and it was basically a conversation describing what had just happened. That immediacy, that sense of exigency was not present when these statements, if they were made, were then purportedly made to the wife's best friend and her brother. The exigency had passed. This is a situation like that, it described in one of the cases in Davis v. Washington, one of the first cases decided by the Supreme Court post-Crawford, addressing what exactly is testimonial. The court also addressed that in conjunction with a companion case, Hammond v. Indiana. Davis was the case where the declarant called 911 and reported, "He's here jumping on me again." That was held not to be testimonial because it was made in the midst of an ongoing emergency by someone seeking help. In the companion case, though, Hammond v. Indiana, they described the statements in that case as a narrative of past events delivered at some remove in time from the danger she described. That's what we have here. If you look at the hearing outside the presence of the jury and what Ms. Marine and Mr. Rahman testified to, it's clear that the abuse she was describing was in the past. It was not, these statements made by her were not made in the midst of an ongoing emergency. This was not, again, to quote from Hammond, the provision of information enabling officers immediately to end a threatening situation. This was a narrative of past events, not what the Supreme Court has basically carved out of the testimonial definition. These were testimonial statements. Also, I noticed something when I was reading the state's brief, specifically with regards to the testimony of Saika Marine, who testified first, and then Mr. Rahman testified later in the trial. I noticed that everything the state relied on as evidence to support the court's finding of forfeiture by wrongdoing and that these statements were an excited utterance was testified to after the court had made its ruling. It was statements made by Ms. Marine and Mr. Rahman on the witness stand before the jury. And it's well settled that a trial court's ruling is generally reviewed based on what is before the trial court at the time of its ruling. Now, of course, the court could consider what Ms. Marine testified to on the stand as well as outside the presence of the jury when weighing the admissibility of Mr. Rahman's testimony, since she testified first. But specifically with regard to the testimony of Saika Marine, or Shulu, what was before the trial court at the ruling, at the time of its ruling, did not support its finding of forfeiture or excited utterances. And on that, the state also relies on the Avant case and on the Pickering case to say that these were excited utterances. The problem, and this is why we quoted that lengthy block quote from Ms. Marine's testimony in our brief, it's clear that these were not excited utterances. They were not made during or in the immediate aftermath of the startling or shocking event that she described. Again, that is what distinguishes this from Avant and the Pickering case, where the statements were either made in the midst of the abuse or whatever the traumatic event that supposedly triggered the excited utterance, or in the immediate aftermath of it. This case is more like, we cited a couple of cases in our brief. I want to reference a couple other for the court. Sandoval v. State, that's 409 Southwest 3rd, 259. This is again, the statements at issue in that case, which the Court of Appeals held were not excited utterances, were described as a narrative of a painful event, not an excited utterance. And the key quote from that case I found, emotions, even strong ones, do not necessarily demonstrate the lack of time or opportunity to contrive or misrepresent information. Problem with the statements in this case, even if the court finds forfeiture or that the statements were not testimonial and therefore the confrontation clause objection was properly overruled, they are still hearsay. They were not excited utterances because there was no showing that she did not have time to reflect and basically fabricate allegations of abuse. Martinez v. State, that's a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 2005. The site on that is 178 Southwest 3rd, 806. In that case, even statements that were just 2 days removed from the abuse that in that case was supposed to be the startling or shocking occurrence that triggered the excited utterance, were held to not fall within the excited utterance exception. In all these cases, Sandoval, Martinez, Barnes, and Reyes, they basically stand for the proposition that it's not enough to prove that something, that there was a startling or shocking event, and that the declarant was upset at the time he or she made the statements. You have to prove that nexus, that she was still, that the statement was spontaneous. So I think that concludes what I have on those issues. Moving on to the conversation that Shulu Marine had with the defendant, allegedly. This was basically her testimony was that he was speaking Urdu and she was translating as best she could. She speaks Bengali, but she knows some Hindi. The state relies on this case from one of the Houston Courts of Appeals, Castrejon. In that case, the facts were very different. You had a police officer testifying about a conversation that was partially in English and partially in Spanish. And even though the officer in Castrejon claimed that, or did testify that she was not fluent in Spanish, she also testified that she dealt with Spanish-speaking suspects quite frequently, that she had taken Spanish classes, whereas in this case, we have testimony before the trial court's ruling that Shulu had not taken classes in Urdu, basically the officer in Castrejon spoke street Spanish, which was what many suspects who solicit prostitutes speak, and she's comfortable speaking it. She's able to get her points across so that she can understand what people are saying to her. And big difference, in that case, there was actually a recording of the conversation that was played for the jury. In this case, the jury did not have that benefit. It was established that the conversation was not recorded. And we believe the only case I could find on point, the only case that's mandatory authority from this court is that Coleman v. Medlinka case from the Texas Supreme Court, where they basically say that if the witness deliberately assumes to understand the language, then it's okay to testify without an interpreter. But that standard was not met in this case. She testified that she didn't know Urdu. She spoke Bengali and Hindi. And again, also, all this, it's well briefed by the state about the similarities between Urdu and Hindi. The problem is, again, that information was not presented to the trial court, and so it was not before the trial court at the time of its ruling. I say I'm about out of time. Basically, our arguments on the safe haven evidence and the testimony of Sharon Fonville Bauman, we think this is pretty well briefed. We're just asking that the court basically apply the same rule from civil cases to this one. Both this court and the Texas Supreme Court have said you cannot get around notice requirements or in civil discovery requirements by calling a witness in rebuttal when you manifest an intent to call her in your case in chief. And for the same reason, or a similar reason, not exactly the same, the safe haven evidence should not have also been admitted because the defense did not receive reasonable notice. And even though it was brought up on cross-examination, again, the state indicated an intent to introduce it in its case in chief. And so it cannot, it can't credibly claim that, well, this was admissible rebuttal evidence. We didn't know what the defendant was going to say on the stand. The state clearly wanted to get this evidence before the jury, and certainly through Sharon Fonville Bauman's testimony, tried to get it before the jury at, see, my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington. Mr. Condor.
May it please the court, Stephen Condor for the state of Texas. There are a lot of things that are fairly straightforward in this case, and they're clear. That on April 16, 2016, the defendant got his gun and shot his wife in the kitchen of their house while she was trying to call 911. He fled the scene, and when he returned, they found the gun in his car. The gun had his DNA on it. The bullets from the gun matched the bullet recovered from the victim's body, and it matched the casing on the floor, and he made admissions to a variety of people that he had shot his wife. To the police detective and to Ms. Bauman from CPS. The primary issue that seems to be argued about is the out-of-court statements made by Mrs. Zafar to her brother and to her friend. And so when looking at these statements, we have to look at kind of the hierarchy of it. Does it violate the Constitution? Does it violate a statute? Does it violate a rule? Now, the issue, and the competition really wasn't covered that well at the trial, but I think that it's key, is our Crawford says a confrontation involves statements that are testimonial in nature. And you have to look at the primary purpose of the statement made. Was it made for purposes of law enforcement or to be used in the court later? And in Ohio versus Clark, the Supreme Court said you had to really look at who was the statement made to. Was it someone charged with uncovering or prosecuting criminal behavior? What I think is most significant is in the Giles versus California case, where they specifically said that they talked about how Crawford applies to testimonial statements, those that are only excluded by the Confrontation Clause. In that, they said statements to friends and neighbors about abuse and intimidation are only applied to hearsay rules. They're not part of the confrontation. And I think that's what the cases the state cited in its brief are. Davlin, Woods, all about that testimonial deals with situations where it's done primarily for court purposes. And I think if you look at Giles, you see the statement in question was one made to a police officer as part of a domestic violence report. As for the forfeiture by wrongdoing, I think again in Giles, and it's cited in the state's brief, that when looking at forfeiture by wrongdoing as an exception to confrontation, you have to look at domestic violence as different. And if you look at the isolation, the defendant makes a great point about the fact that, yes, Mrs. Zafar was allowed to travel and was allowed to do certain things. But I think what's key and important is it says, was the crime expressly intended to isolate the victim and stop her from reporting abuse to the authorities or cooperating with the criminal prosecution, which is language straight from Giles versus California. And just keep in mind that What was the victim doing when she was shot? She was on the phone calling 911. And I think that is a critical aspect in this case. As for the hearsay issues, I think it's clear that she was acting under stress of studying the event, that she was dominated by emotions. It was emotion driven. One case pointed out in the state's brief is that in the case of McCarty, the Court of Appeals held that the excited utterance is not limited, it's not spontaneous utterances, it's not limited to just an event that just happened, that they can be, an event can startle recollections of prior events. But the issue I really want to kind of point out to the court is on the Tiffany Flores rebuttal testimony issue. Because that I just want to remind the court that when you look at it, look at what Mrs. Flores actually testified about Safe Haven. I think the court recognized that due to some invency, she was not given proper notice, and that's why she didn't let her testify guilt, innocence. But she only allowed her to testify after the defendant testified, and the state points out in its brief the fact that her rebuttal testimony, Ms. Flores, was only a direct response to testimony given by the defendant. That puts her clearly in the category of a rebuttal witness, even if the state had originally intended to call her beforehand. I think the state's brief fairly outlines most of the other points that were raised by the defense, and therefore we pray for an affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Condor. Rebuttal, Mr. Arrington?
Thank you, Your Honor.
So first I have to correct myself. There were two witnesses who testified about the Safe Haven BIP intake forms. One was Sharon Fonville-Obama and the other was Tiffany Flores. Obviously Tiffany Flores was the witness called in rebuttal. But the fact still matters. We think that before the court addresses whether or not her testimony could fairly be characterized as rebuttal testimony, it's important to address this threshold inquiry of whether or not you can call a witness in rebuttal who was not listed when the state manifested an intent to call her in its case in chief. And
well, Mr. Arrington, was there anything about Ms. Flores' testimony that you felt was not in direct response to something that the defendant testified to? Did she go beyond the scope of pure rebuttal?
I would have, without looking at the record, I can't say for sure. Without having the record in front of me, I would have to go back and examine that, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I can't give you a straight yes or no on that right now. But as far as that, and then the evidence, the actual Safe Haven intake packet. If you interpret the notice requirements of Rule 404B and the exception for rebuttal, which I'm familiar with the case law as the case cited Jobert and those other cases, it says, you know, generally doesn't apply to evidence offered in rebuttal or on cross-examination. But if you interpret it in the way they're applying it in this case, it would mean that the state could basically just get around the notice requirements by saving extraneous act evidence for cross-examination of the defense witness and something, or the defendant himself, something inconsistent with the purpose of Rule 404B and its corollary for punishment, Article 3707, Section 3. In Washington v. State, this court said that the state must notify the defendant of all evidence it intends to introduce against the defendant in its case in chief. And the defendant is told of evidence that will be directly introduced against him. So this isn't a situation where basically applying or holding the state to the notice requirement in this case would require the state to anticipate any possible defensive theory. That's what courts have said in the past would be an absurd application. We agree with that. We're not asking this court to overrule past case law. It's just in keeping with the standard and the purpose of the rule to prevent unfair surprise to the defendant. And also, on as far as the extraneous nature of the acts introduced, we do take issue with the state's characterization that the state only offered this as proof that that Mr. Zafar has given multiple accounts of how Mrs. Zafar's shooting death occurred. We think it's pretty clear from the record they offered this as bad act evidence, and you read the closing argument, it's clear the purpose for which they wanted to get this into evidence. So I think we've addressed that. Getting back to the forfeiture and excited utterance issues, as far as the forfeiture, I think it's significant that Mr. Rahman's testimony, when asked outside the presence of the jury, why did she say she didn't want you to call the police, he responds, I don't know. So the evidence before the trial court, again, did not support a finding that this was a case of forfeiture by wrongdoing like that described in the dicta in Giles. And I think everything else is pretty adequately briefed. So They relied on the McCarty case. I won't go through the different things to consider from McCarty, so I think we've pretty well articulated our arguments, and we would just ask that because this case involves so many issues of first impression, that whatever your resolution of this case, that you order your opinion be published. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington. Gentlemen, your case is submitted. We appreciate the time you took to come argue. And with that, court is adjourned.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned. You're dismissed.